Hello, I'm Cathy McDonald, and you're listening to The Practice of Reason. In this sequence of three lectures on war, we listen to philosophers discuss moral issues in the past, present and future of warfare. Recorded live at the 2008 Australasian Association of Philosophy Conference, Melbourne. Here now is Nicholas Evans from the Australian National University with The Ethical Consequences of Emerging Neurowarfare Technology.
You'll have to forgive me if I read technical issues and there is no PowerPoint. Recent years have seen the emergence of a set of technologies classified by Stephen White as neurowarfare. Not to be confused with PSYOPs, which is psychological and neurological attacks on combatants, neurowarfare is the guidance of robotic military hardware through direct neural connection. This technology has been pioneered by the Defence Advanced Research Projects Agency, DARPA, in the United States over the last decade, and has resulted from new insights into the translation of electrochemical processes within the brain corresponding to various physical phenomena. These technologies, termed human-assisted neural devices, or HANDS, by DARPA, contribute to a wider discussion regarding the dual-use dilemma. It's a contested area of science and security circles regarding the regulation of emerging life sciences technologies. There has been recent publication regarding technologies whose progressions are converging with the life sciences, famously information, nanoscale, and neuroscience technologies. The dual-use dilemma in science has existed for much of recorded Western scientific history, most notably in the formative years of the nuclear age. Dual-use may refer to a number of different phenomena presented here in the order that they've been used historically. Early usage of the term implied civilian and military uses of a certain piece of technology, which informed decision-making processes in export control concerns to potentially unfriendly countries, or as economic considerations in the development of such technologies. More relevant is the conception of dual-use technologies as those technologies which have morally permissible and impermissible applications. The special case here is that the impermissible applications are associated with weapons of mass destruction, highlighting the malevolent applications of dual-use technology. Lastly, dual-use technology or technology may have dual-use potential if it has a multiple applications which either have the ability to help or harm humanity. While the first of these definitions casts no judgment over the moral status of such applications, the second and third do. The second is, in essence, a narrower definition of the third, and focuses primarily on the proliferation of WMDs. While WMDs may be used in conjunction with the technology I'm going to talk about, this isn't what I consider the greatest scope of this technology, so I'm going to be referring to the last of these dual-use potentials. It's the dual-use aspect of hand technology that I wish to address. While the application of hand technologies may be beneficial, assisting people in the operation of prostheses and improving the functional lives of those who suffer from motor impairment disorders, the very fact that this project has been championed by DARPA underscores its substantial military potential. With any military technology advance comes the increased potency of weapon systems. The article that inspired me outlined one of the problematic aspects of these neuroweapons technologies. Stephen White explains that while neuroweapons are most likely allowed under current international arms agreements, the creation of a neural interface between machine and operator may create a case where the voluntariness or conscious action of a war crime may be called into question, undermining the strength of international war crime law. I agree with White's arguments, but over the course of this paper I wish to illustrate that he's not gone far enough. The problematic aspects of neurowarfare technology extend to a much broader range of issues than he describes. In particular, I wish to explore the ethical consequences of the use of neurowarfare technologies in combat. So I'm going to develop this paper as follows. First, hand technology will be outlined to introduce the reader to the development of the technology over the last few years and provide clarification on the technical aspects of this field. Then I want to outline the basic positive and negative potential aspects of this technology before exploring the negative consequences in more depth. Finally, I hope to offer a few potential solutions to these problems raised. Okay, so the story so far. While research has been pursued on hands for a number of years, it is only the 21st century where appreciable progress has been made in realising this technology. Since the late stages of the 20th century, the technologies corresponding to the interpretation of the electronic structure of the brain, identifying corresponding between actions and signals within that structure, and translating that signal into one that can be transmitted to an external device, have improved significantly. These advances have made possible the creation of the brain-computer interface. The brain-computer interface still faces many technical issues, such as size, portability, and implantation methods. At the moment, when you implant it, you can't ever take it out without killing the subject. However, as miniaturization techniques continue to improve, itself a contested issue within nanoethics, the creation of a compact and reliable brain control interface is not far away. So close is this technology to full realization that CyberKinetics, an American biotech firm, has been conducting clinical trials on motor-impaired patients since 2003. So the iconic demonstration of this technology's feasibility is Belle, who is an owl monkey, and she was the first successful test subject at the Defense Science Office of DARPA. Belle, a monkey, was originally given a computer game to play where she used a joystick to move a cursor in response to flashing lights, which would result in rewards of fruit. Belle mastered the game slowly, and as she did, her brain signals in her motor cortex were mapped in conjunction with how she moved the joystick back and forth. A hand device was planted into her motor cortex, and the joystick itself was unplugged. So when she started to play the game again, there was no actual response coming from the joystick itself, but instead her decision-making processes associated with her motor cortex were picked up by the hand, and this created the effect of responding to the stimuli of the video game. Eventually, Belle actually figured out that the joystick was of no use, and so there are videos of this little monkey basically sitting watching a screen and controlling the computer game with her mind. So Belle was able to respond to the game stimuli using only thought processes. Now, the interest in DARPA has enhanced it in hand devices stems in part from its dual-use potential. Two potential applications are being explored at DARPA. The first is the restoration of functionality to individuals otherwise experiencing limited or negligible ability to manipulate their environment. And the second is the enhancement of capacities to an otherwise functionally complete individual. I want to discuss each of these in turn. In the restoration scenario, the development of hands leads to the realization of better functionality to individuals suffering from motor impairment disorders, such as paralytic tetraplegia or amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, or ALS. In all such disorder, a major challenge is that of physically interacting with society. Persons suffering from motor impairment disorders may be unable to exercise gross or fine motor control in order to move around and manipulate their environment. In more advanced cases, epitomized by popular figures such as Stephen Hawking, who suffers from ALS, this manifests in an inability to care for oneself or communicate without significant aid. In all of these cases, the essential function of the hand is to restore lost or missing functionality to an individual. This is the work of individuals such as Michael Goldblatt of DARPA, who has cited a chief inspiration in his role as project manager of the hand project as his daughter, who suffers from severe cerebral palsy. Restoration of functionality to those suffering physical disabilities has raised contentious issues. While accepted on the surface as good by the majority of the population, there are certain elements of the population who, among others, feel that certain classes of disability are not, as it were, disabilities, and thus trying to cure them is morally impermissible. Most famous of these groups are the deaf culturists, who view their status as a cultural rather than disability group based on the presence of a shared language, sign language. The ethical aspects of the cochlear implant have been discussed extensively, so I will only touch on the issue. Hand technology is functionally similar to the cochlear implant, but has an interactive component in the ability to both not only receive information, but to allow the wearer to transmit it. The cochlear implant has been a particularly sore point for deaf culturists. However, there's a fundamental difference I see between deafness and motor impairment disorders. As deaf culturists rightly point out, deafness with its own language is fast becoming a self-sustaining culture and community, while the dependence on carers by those who suffer from severe motor impairment disorders are such that they remain more dependent on the wider community. The formation of a language by the deaf culture has removed their dependence on cochlear implants or similar technology to flourish in this world. In this way, their claims of cochlear implants as unnecessary are correct, and in time, this may be seen as cosmetic rather than essential. For many who suffer from motor impairment disorders, the opinion on restorative technology does not seem to exist in this sense. Rather, if a person suffering from profound motor impairment does become fully integrated and autonomous within society, it will be precisely because of this technology and not in spite of it. As such, I don't believe this objection requires further analysis, at least in this paper. In the case of persons suffering from motor impairment disabilities, I believe hand technology represents an unequivocal positive in realising partial, if not total, restoration of function. If hands were to be realised as mainstream items of technology, the potential is there that, in the foreseeable future, sufferers of motor impairment disability will be able to gain or regain full body functionality. In his positive heaven scenario, Joel Garreau refers to a time when it is, and I quote, as hard to tell a person is physically handicapped as it is to guess their original hair colour. This would greatly reduce the stigmatisation suffered by such individuals. As the technology improves, such individuals will be able to fulfil a greater range of interests and projects in life, one hopes even eventually up to and equal to individuals who do not suffer from any such impairment. In this way, I view the hand as a great positive social force. Okay, so I want to move on to the enhancement scenarios now and for the rest of the paper. Although the restoration scenarios will undoubtedly bring numerous complications, I wish to turn to the enhancement scenario now for the rest of this paper as it presents the most important ethical concerns to me. In the enhancement scenario, otherwise fully biological function individuals, and I do use that term very carefully here, are augmented by hands in order to fulfill tasks with the dexterity of simple motor tasks, but on a scale or complexity that would currently require a mechanical proxy. For example, there are environments where humans cannot venture without prohibitive amounts of shielding, if at all. Tasks performed inside nuclear reactors, actively volcanic regions, or deep sea exploration would also benefit from such technology. Likewise, natural or man-made cleanup may benefit from hand-controlled devices, and law enforcement may find use for them in bomb disposal, and the military will undoubtedly find use in hands. The enhancement scenario brings out many potential benefits to humanity as described above. Adding to the desire to utilize this technology in the scenarios outlined, the changing nature of our world will provide greatest pressure for hand technology to be used. As society develops increasingly large energy needs and rapidly changing environmental conditions due to human and man-made factors such as global warming or climate change continue to shape our world, there will come a time when the accurate and swift level of control presented by the human motor system may need to be exercised with the strength and resistance to punishment that comes from a machine. It is here that hands become instrumental in allowing remote negotiation of multiple hostile factors with the precision that comes from direct physical human intervention. It may also make coordination of large projects such as construction easier, with either individual or network groups of individuals controlling multiple hands simultaneously in problems in order to complete specific tasks with unmatched coherence and cooperation. While I won't discuss it here, there has already been talk amongst DARPA circles regarding the use of hands to link people to other people, and not just people to machines. To introduce the problematic aspects of this technology, I want to quote Matthew Messelson, who, in a report in 2004, was quoted as saying, "Every major technology, metallurgy, explosives, internal combustion, aviation, electronics, nuclear energy, has been intensively exploited not only for peaceful purposes, but for hostile ones. As our technology gets progressively more advanced, the stakes of each such endeavour become progressively higher. In the case of hands, the military applications have serious consequences for just war theory." So that's where I'm going to turn to now. I'm going to make some clarifications quickly. I do assume here that there is a certain amount of remote access being performed by these types of devices. So it doesn't seem to me logical that you would suit someone up with this expensive medical technology only to put them into a combat situation physically. So the Predator drones are already being used within the United States military, so it seems to follow that once these are introduced into the military, and I assume that at this stage they will be, what will happen is you will have operators controlling from great distances. So at the moment the Predator drones are controlled from somewhere in Nevada, and they fly around Iraq, Afghanistan. So I assume the same thing here. I'm also assuming that we're relying on technical perfection of these devices. The reason I do this is that a lot of talks regarding the problems of robotic weaponry platforms or robots in general come from technical issues and unexpected possibilities. However, I believe that there are enough ethical issues presented only with fully functioning devices of this nature, so I'm not going to be dealing with this with the substantial technical issues faced within these technologies. Okay, so we're talking about just war now, and whenever one talks about just war, considerations are invariably broken down into one of two categories: jus ad bellum, the justice of war, or jus in bello, the justice in war. Jus ad bellum focuses on the justice of going to war in the first place, including considerations such as going to war with legitimate authority, just cause, a formal declaration, reasonable hopes of success, proportionate response, and just intention. Jus in bello is the just fighting of a war, such as respecting the moral equivalent of combatants, the immunity of non and ex-combatants, and the aversion of infliction of unnecessary suffering, and a sense of proportion within your attacks. I draw all of these from primarily writers such as Walzer and Childress. While there is a school of just war developing in current times which doesn't view things such as proportionality as relevant, I wish to hold to this because, frankly, I think that they're wrong. In order to make consistency, I'll be framing all the ethical issues where I can presented by these technologies in relation to these principles. So I want to develop four problems relating to the hand, three within sort of the context of jus in bello and one within jus ad bellum. So we're going to start with jus in bello and then we'll move on to jus ad bellum. Okay. So with regards to jus in bello, let's start with the smallest unit of combat, which I'm taking to be the individual soldier. Joanna Burke rightly points out that the role of a soldier in relation to her spatial relationship to enemy combatants has changed over time. This in turn has changed the way in which the enemy is viewed by a soldier. This has been understood that at a time when combatants fought at very close range, combat and treatment of ex-combatants were approached with a certain eye towards reciprocity. We do not do to one side what we would not have done to the other. Well, this coincides with principles or proportionality and moral equivalent combatants with Ingus in Bello. I believe that it is also a non-intellectual moral practice that has been present to a greater or lesser extent throughout the history of combat. Chivalry, warrior codes, and the rules of engagement all seem predicated on a certain sense of common humanity possessed by soldiers. This is not consistent in all wars, to be sure. History provides us with liberal counter-examples. However, I believe that there is enough in a way of example to show that if there is indeed a way war should be fought, it is with the intention towards proportionality of response rather than without it. Technological advances redefine spatial dimensions in war, leading to an expansion of conflict zones. War is still objective-based, but the surrounds of this objective have been expanded as the effective range of combatants has increased. From the immediacy of beating one another with sticks, to the invention of the projectile, to aerial combat, the zone around the military conflict has increased so as to make war more and more isolated for any individual soldier. Over time, this has weakened but not entirely removed principles of reciprocity from war. What sets the hands apart is the engagement zone. It has not changed with the introduction of the hand. Shots are still fired across similar ranges, objectives stay where they are, and the units converge from similar distances. But the corporeal human form, which seems to me to be one of the deciding factors, though not the only factor, in the psychology of the reciprocity principle, is absent. Jess Wolfendale notes that in considering the state of professional armies in the 21st century, that soldiers should understand the laws of war as practitioners of that trade. She also notes that in today's armies, this is not the case, and the Surgeon General's report of mental health of soldiers and Marines engaged in Operation Iraqi Freedom give credible evidence to her claim. The report reads, "Approximately 10% of soldiers and Marines report mistreating non-combatants. Soldiers that have a high level of anger, experience high levels of combat, or those who have screened positive for mental health problems were nearly twice as likely to mistreat non-combatants. Over 47% of soldiers and 38% of United States Marines agreed that non-combatants should be treated with dignity and respect." So the other proportion thought that non-combatants should not be treated with such dignity and respect. "Well over a third of soldiers and Marines reported torture should be allowed, whether to save the life of a fellow soldier or obtain important information about insurgents. 17% of soldiers agreed or strongly agreed that all non-combatants should be treated as insurgents de facto." These statistics, combined with the removal of physical presence of a soldier on the battlefield, lead me to believe that the hand technology will increase violations of the principles of moral equivalence of soldiers and respect for non- and ex-combatants. It would seem plausible to claim that the above statistics arise in part due to training soldiers undergo when they join the army. It is often brutal, dehumanizing, and places emphasis on obedience over understanding. The urgency of war is programmed into soldiers as part of standard training. And while it's claimed that the rules of engagement are also part of standard training, it would not seem from the above statistics that either this is given high priority or it is taught sufficiently well to stick. So take the above state of affairs and insert a piece of technology such as the hand. While the purpose of a hand is to feed sensory data from the combat zone directly into a soldier on the other end, the soldier is nevertheless shielded from the harshest realities of combat, namely, that she may die. The practice of moral conduct within war is up for debate as the psychology of war within the context of actual combat, in which I don't believe there is time to engage in continuous rational reflection on one's action. To further remove a soldier from combat is to trivialise combat, and I believe that this will make for the potential for soldiers to act justly, given their training, diminished. The practice of the principle of moral equivalence of soldiers and proportionality is dependent on a certain identity shared between soldiers, and to remove a soldier from the combat zone jeopardizes their ability to form this identity and detrimentally affects the possibility of realizing the moral equivalence condition supported in just war theory. Now, I just want to touch quickly on a comment made to me by Dan Starr. There's been a possibility raised that the presence of an interface between the combat site and the soldier could result in cooler, calmer operations by soldiers in combat. Now, this was also suggested at the time that aerial combat began to become more and more utilised, and that hasn't happened of yet. So I don't believe that this coincides with existing precedents set by activities such as that, and even if we observe civilian use of things like computer games. Although hands will provide extra sensory data than current computer games, obviously, the relevant effect, the removal of the body of the soldier from combat, is no different from the abstraction achieved in playing of a computer game. In this case, however, the play has very real consequences for the opponent. I also want to touch quickly on one more point regarding this. I want you to imagine now a pilot of a hand encountering an ethical dilemma in which she has time to consider this combat situation. orders say one thing, but her moral considerations cause her to hesitate. Suddenly, she's performing an impermissible action against her own will, as her commanding officer either taps herself into the robot or engages an automatic program to take care of the job for her. The pilot is left unable to resist, as sensory information shows her the full extent of the morally impermissible action she's taking, and left to live with the feelings of actions that were not hers, that she did not experience, that she experienced nonetheless. Jessica Wolfendahl's recent article regards the compromised agencies of combatants, due to the performance-enhancing technologies. While Wolfendahl concentrates largely on the pharmaceuticals that soldiers take during combat, she does make mention of hands, more so than merely establishing a mens rea, as Stephen Wider suggested, with regards to these hands technology. I believe the problems associated with the loss of autonomy by an agent who must watch and experience the committing of an action she has no will to perform are great indeed and very problematic. So the next problem, and perhaps a deeper problem regarding the use of hands, is the presence of vast increases in military hardware per combatant in dollar values. Consider that each United States soldier in the current war in Iraq costs approximately $17,500 to equip. Recent reports that the Objective Force Warrior project, to be released by the United States military by 2012, will elevate this figure up to $60,000 per combatant. This, I believe, calls into the question the ability of a soldier to make decisions when faced with the burden of the sheer amount of money that's been spent on her. Although it may be possible to work a novel thought experiment through to the not-so-distant future in regard to the ethical problems presented by these financial pressures, 20th century science fiction has already done my work for me. I'm referring to Robert Heinlein's Starship Troopers. The book opens with the protagonist, Johnny, waiting for a drop in a combat zone, and his commanding officer informs his platoon, "I want to remind you apes that every one of you has cost the government, counting weapons, armor, ammo, instrumentation, and training. Everything, including the way you overeat, has cost on the hoof better than $500,000. So bring it back. We can spare you, but we can't spare that fancy suit you're wearing." The economic rationale for engaging in a war has been alluded to by the critics of the Gulf War. That applying a military option in Iraq that is, in essence, an economic problem has been considered a great failure of modern just war theory within policy. However, converging neurowarfare technologies, informed by this fictional example above, paint a different, more troubling picture. In this picture, even a justly declared war could be jeopardized by the behavior of troops more concerned with their gear than with their conduct. Heinlein's book does refer to instances where the mobile infantry take better care of each other than considerations for the gear. However, with a hand, the absence of the agent's corporeal form, as presumably their presence would still be there owing to sensory input from the robot that they control, would remove the extreme urgency of battle, making the dominant priority of the soldier the maintenance of their robotic vehicle. The fact that robots can be designed with carrying capacities far in excess of a soldier means that very costly robots can be placed in any individual soldier's hands. At a high enough level, I suspect this would be enough to begin to override prohibitions against unnecessary suffering. It is this reality that proposes serious moral consequences for Yussin Bello. While Walserian notions of the spheres of money and military are traditionally used in scenarios such as his example of the 1863 Conscription Act, the case above seems to outline another point at which financial interests of a group should not be allowed to compete with the interests others have in preserving their lives. I'm not talking about neuro-warriors preserving their machines through evasive tactics, etc. Rather, I'm referring to actions that could be taken from their perspective of expediency that violates one of the mandates of Yussin Bello. For example, say a group of enemy combatants are contained to a building that is known to contain hundreds of non-combatants. Non-combatant immunity states that the building itself should be preserved, or all efforts be made to preserve the lives of non-combatants while engaging the combatants. However, out of an interest for maintaining her robot, the neuro-warrior operates to level the building and eliminate the combatants, a process made almost negligible in difficulty with $500,000 in high-tech weaponry per robot, or even $4 million for a Predator drone, which is currently in service. Such a violation of Yussin Bello may be possible without hand devices, but I believe it would be increasingly more likely as the cost of each combatant become higher that the policy of military bodies would begin to change from leave no man behind to something akin to leave no man's gear behind. The possibility that financial concern may impact on military decisions is not new. War has been noted to be highly political, and in a market-driven international society, it would seem that logical that financial concerns would play into decisions to go to war. It is, after all, costly. However, Yussin Bello and Yussin Bello would indicate that the going to war as a means of exercising control over a financial cause is unjust. Likewise, and particular to this case, rationalizing military decisions as described within war based on financial efficacy seems to be a decision-making process that could contradict the requirements of Yussin Bello, and this cannot be tolerated. This is not to say that saving resources in the process of waging war is not an admirable element of strategy. Rather, it is the visitation of US embargo-violating methods in an effort to curtail expenditures that would be unjust. If a combatant, no longer has to worry about keeping her life in war, but instead about having her damages to her hand showing up negatively in a supervisory report, there is no room to commit what may amount to a war crime in lieu of being just. Okay, so I'm going to turn to jus ad bellum now. The problems raised in the previous two sections are serious, but I believe that there's one more concern which is far more pressing in regards to the perception of war by the public. It is this attitude and the military and public alike which I wish to explore. It appears to be a central tenet of non-romantic just war theory, that war is a condition that, while sometimes necessary, is unfortunate. This should be obvious to many people because war is often considered to be horrific. Michael Walzer refers to war as the crime of war, and Tony Cody refers to it as the moral scandal of war. The late Philip Dalton remarks on the problem of the horror of war as the public perceives it. Dalton writes, "Our images of death and warfare part company with reality when we turn to the human experience into an idealized one, and by doing so deny the reality of that combat experience. It is an attitude which explained as part of romantic militarism by writers such as Tony Cody. The romantic militarism that is problematic in today's society is partly due to the way we glorify the soldiers. To be sure, soldiers deserve our respect, and because there are wars that have been fought in the name of justice. But the horror of war is screened from the public consciousness, and this idealization is tempered only by a fundamental fact, that in war, people die. On some level, the majority of citizens of a country understand this, and it is rare to find a person whose life has not been touched by war in some measure. To be sure, there are many factors that override this understanding and its full import, nor should the true horror of war stay our hand in the event of just cause. But that it exists, this is the horror of war, places temperance on the drive to go to war for the individual citizen, the military man, and, one hopes, the politician. How does this relate to neuro-warfare? Imagine a world where one country, or many, possesses the ability to go to war without committing troops in the sense of providing physical, human presence on the ground, or conceivably on or under the water or in the air. The realities of war disappear in part because the reality of the horrors of war disappear, at least for this side in question. War ceases to have human cost. Financial burdens will still play a factor, but at least in the initial assessment, this often does not appear to be a deciding factor for the citizens who support war. I speak here of a balancing act between two questions. Is this worth fighting for, and is this worth dying for? In a country where the norm has been the application of remotely operated I believe that the latter question ceases to exist. It is presumptuous and cynical to assume that a person with nothing to lose will do with it whatever they please. Indeed, a warfighter may have something to lose in controlling a hand, as noted in previous sections. However, I do not think it presumptuous to acknowledge that war as a political exercise, one of the few things that could limit a war is the potential for mass death on one side. The phenomenon of casualty aversion has been discussed in armed forces and sociology circles by writers such as Hugh Smith. The recent or lack of recent Iraqi casualty reports from 2003 to present war in Iraq seem to have little effect on public perceptions of war, but the two greatest motivators for anti-war sentiment appear the loss of coalition life and durations of term of service. As noted, if using hands in conventional war, casualties of the side possessing the hand will be severely diminished. Now imagine a war where a warfighter returns from her tour of duty to her family every night after she's finished her shift, plugged into a mechanized weapons platform some 10,000 kilometers away. She has no chance of dying in combat. War has become a day job, as easy to get to and engaged in as working at a call center, although perhaps, but not certainly, requiring more training. What of justice? It is impossible to give any definitive answers. One can look at possibilities. It seems that there is evidence that those serving in the armed forces do not view their opponents with the same sense of justice that just war theory requires. While this makes no difference to normative expectations of what we should expect from our soldiers, it does make a difference in how we may hold them accountable. Pending some radical shift in the ethics of soldiers, if reciprocity is negated because there is no moral consequences for the loss of a unit, one may wonder if there is any disposition to mistreat one's opponent would be magnified. It is certain that those at home, through propaganda and the us-versus-them mentality that is often entailed in such propaganda, share the animosity of those troops towards the enemy, in some ways more so. This casts serious doubts on the possibility that war can ever be just with such technologies in place. Although such an effect may influence the ethics of a soldier in war, I think the more frightening possibility of this problem is the effects on greater society. A society that has no conception of the cost of war has no reason not to go to war. Bear in mind that, unfortunately, the information the public has when they base their support of a war is primarily what a government tells them. If there is no risk and only propaganda, then a more belligerent society would appear to be more guaranteed. It is this case that would seem to be most troubling. Western societies around the world already experience problems with violent communities, but a community-wide increase in belligerence would most certainly be problematic. Okay, I want to give you my views on potential remedies to this, but only quickly because I'm running out of time. So I want to start with those on the ground and work back up, much like I did with explaining the problems. The soldier is first and foremost responsible for her action in combat, and as the last link of the chain in command, is the one who will carry out orders. She forms the focus for the societal conditioning, political manipulation, military training, and ideological basis for any order carried out during a war. She is also, in some ways, furthest removed from the perils of jus ad bellum, going to war, but closely and intimately of the demands of jus in bello, how she fights. If we are to counteract the problematic aspects of the hand, we can't only rely or hold accountable our soldiers in regards to doing the right thing, but we have to empower them to be able to do the right thing. Now, it's this empowerment that I hope will lead to, most favourably, the cool and calm condition described above and noted to me by Daniel Starr. Just war theory tends to focus heavily on the strategist, who is the greater instigator for the progress of war, and their methods. It can be considered an impermissible strategy under just war theory to shoot one's own soldiers for responding to the terrors of battles, as discussed in as occurred in Stalingrad. However, soldiers are responsible for a lesser and somewhat untouched aspect of just war theory, in that they become tacticians at a local level. So, with regards to the soldier, and indeed her commanding officers to a lesser extent, in order to counteract the problematic aspects provided by hands to troops in the field, a hypothetical army would be required to be trained under a substantially different set of practices to those that have been proliferated historically by Western nations. The domain of just war theory, as I said, is the domain of set of society who do not generally experience frontline combat, or when they write of just war, do so after combat experience. Even then, the practice of individual soldiers who may be considered tacticians is separated from those who write on the greater phenomena of war, the strategist. The just war theorist comments on both, but particularly the greater function of war. The moral psychology of the soldier, integral to the end result of war, appears to be left on the wayside. Yet it's this mindset of the soldiers that with these technologies become increasingly important. As war becomes more automated, the manpower required on the line diminishes. Thus, the actions of a single soldier become more representative of the outcome of a particular battle. Soldiers are required to become better educated in the realities of the profession, which requires a firmer commitment to the tenets of the theory of just war. Without it, these soldiers, serving more and more influent points within an army, pose more and more danger to the prospect of ever realizing just war. Now, this isn't a novel approach to battle, and it's often associated with pacifistic measures toward most regarded in sort of Eastern treatises towards war. So people like Motohei Oshiba, right, he wrote a treatise called The Art of Peace. And while it's essentially a pacifistic doctrine that actually doesn't advocate killing at all, I don't think this is incompatible with modern theories of just war. Certainly not be incompatible with very far-right realist schools. But when you consider that Ushiba writes primarily on sort of an ultimate notion of reciprocity, in that each action deserves an equal and opposite reaction without either submitting to an unjust action or basically unjustly beating the crap out of your opponent, it seems to be that this is a type of principle which desperately needs to be worked into modern just war theory, because the costs and benefits aspects of just war are more and more becoming aligned with financial costs and responsibilities in regards to, well, how much do we have to commit to a war, how much it's going to cost us to go to war, which doesn't place any emphasis on the fact that there has to be a moral equivalence of soldiers between sides under the tenets of just war. So I just want to quickly turn now to some policymaker problems. We have to be able to hold policymakers and the generals who go to war more responsible for education of troops, battle plans, and why they initiate wars in the first place. Otherwise, we risk running a problem which Christopher Coker outlines when he says, the future is that the president will one day wake up someday, this is the president of the United States he's talking about, and decide that he doesn't like the cut of someone's jib, and send thither infinite number of myrmidons, who are a reference to the Greek soldiers under the command of Achilles in myth, robotic warriors, that could wage a war in which wouldn't have to put at risk our own precious skins. So it becomes really, really important that we view the politicians as increasingly more accountable in how we go to war, how we fight a war, and how we are responsible for the soldiers. There is also a certain responsibility now placed upon the scientists. Now, people who deal heavily with the dual-use dilemma, like Michael Sogolev, claim that we cannot rely solely on scientists to rely on self-regulated procedures. But as Aaron Fitchelberg regards engineers who work within the military-industrial complex, this is precisely, and to a certain extent, what people need to do, and what scientists need to do with themselves, because they are becoming more and more involved in the creation of these technologies. And as some people have suggested, they can potentially become legitimate targets of military action by an opposing side. So it becomes more and more plausible that the best way to stop an enemy going from war is to destroy their technology, and this means killing civilians in the shape of scientists. So I leave these multiple issues up to the audience. And yeah, thanks.
I'm Cathy McDonald, and you have been listening to The Practice of Reason.